Only one generation. This. He swept his arm about as if to encompass the portraits, the landing, and odd, lonely Aloysius Starkweather all in one gesture. Well, no wonder the old man thinks he has the right to throw us out of the place. Mad as hops, my aunt would have said. Shall we go to dinner? In a rare show of gentility, Will offered his arm. Tessa hadn't looked at him as she'd taken it. Will dressed for dinner was handsome enough to take away her breath, and she'd had the feeling she'd need her wits about her. Jem had already been waiting in the dining room when they'd arrived, and Tessa had settled herself beside him to await their host. His place had been set, his plate filled with stew, even his wine glass filled with dark red wine, but there had been no sign of him. It was Will who had shrugged first and begun to eat, though he'd soon looked as if he'd wished he hadn't. "What is this?" he went on now, spearing an unfortunate object on a fork and raising it to eye level. This thing. "A parsnip?" Jem suggested. "A parsnip planted in Satan's own garden," said Will. He glanced about. "I don't suppose there's a dog I could feed it to. There don't seem to be any pets around." Jem, who loved all animals, even the inglorious and ill-tempered church, observed. "Probably all poisoned by parsnips," said Will. "Oh dear," Tessa said sadly, laying her fork down. "And I was so hungry, too." "There's always the dinner rolls," said Will, pointing to a covered basket. "Though I warn you, they're as hard as stones. You could use them to kill black beetles, if any beetles bother you in the middle of the night." Tessa made a face and took a swig of her wine. It was as sour as vinegar. Will set his fork down and began cheerfully, in the manner of Edward Lear's Book of Nonsense. "There once was a lass from New York, who found herself hungry in York. But the bread was like rocks, the parsnips shaped like..."
"You can't rhyme York with York,"
interrupted Tessa.
"It's cheating."
"She's right, you know," said Jem, his delicate fingers playing with the stem of his wine glass. "Especially with fork being so obviously the correct choice." "Good evening." The hulking shadow of Aloysius Starkweather loomed up suddenly in the doorway. Tessa wondered with a flush of embarrassment how long he'd been standing there. "Mr. Herondale, Mr. Carstairs, Miss,
Gray," Tessa said. "Theresa Gray."
"Indeed."
Starkweather made no apologies, just settled himself heavily at the head of the table. He was carrying a square flat box, the sort bankers used to keep their papers in, which he sat down beside his plate. With a flash of excitement, Tessa saw there was a year marked on it, 1825. And even better, three sets of initials. JTS, AES, AHM.
"No doubt your young miss will be pleased to know. I've buckled to her demands and searched the archives all day and half last night besides," Starkweather began in an aggrieved tone.
It took Tessa a moment to realize that in this case, young miss meant Charlotte.
"It's lucky, she is, that my father never threw anything out. And the moment I saw the papers, I remembered."
He tapped his temple.
89 years, and I never forget a thing. You tell old Whelan that when he talks about replacing me."
"We surely will, sir," said Jem, his eyes dancing. Starkweather took a hearty gulp of his wine and made a face.
"By the angel, that stuff's disgusting."
He set the glass down and began pulling papers from the box. "What we have here is an application for reparations on behalf of two warlocks, John and Anne Shade, a married couple.
Now, here's the odd bit,"
the old man went on.
"The filing was done by their son, Axel Hollingworth Mortmain, 22 years old. Now, of course, warlocks are barren."
Will shifted uncomfortably in his seat, his eyes slanting away from Tessa's. "This son was adopted," said Jem.
"Shouldn't be allowed that,"
said Starkweather, taking another slug of the wine he had pronounced disgusting. His cheeks were beginning to redden.
"Like giving a human child to wolves to raise, before the accords."
"If there are any clues to his whereabouts," said Jem, gently trying to steer the conversation back onto its track,
We have very little time.
Very well, very well, snapped Starkweather. There's little information about your precious moat maiden in here, more about the parents. It seems suspicion fell on them when it was discovered that the male warlock, John Shade, was in possession of the Book of the Whites. Quite a powerful spellbook, you understand. Disappeared from the London Institute's library under suspicious circumstances back in 1752. The book specialises in binding and unbinding spells, tying the soul to the body, or untying it, as the case may be. Turned out the warlock was trying to animate things. He was digging up corpses or buying them off medical students and replacing the more damaged bits with mechanisms, then trying to bring them to life. Necromancy. Very much against the law. And we didn't have the Accords in those days. An enclave group swept in and slaughtered both warlocks.
And the child, said Will. Mortmain?
No hide nor hair of him, said Starkweather. We searched, but nothing. Assumed he was dead till his turned up. Cheeky as you please, demanding reparations. Even his address.
His address? Will demanded. That information had not been included in the scroll they had seen at the Institute. In London.
Nay, right here in Yorkshire.
Starkweather tapped the page with a wrinkled finger.
Ravenscar Manor, a massive old pile up north from here. Been abandoned now, I think, for decades.
Now that I think about it, can't figure out how he could have afforded it in the first place.
It's not where the Shades lived.
Still, Jem said, an excellent starting point for us to go looking. If it's been abandoned since his tenancy, there may be things he left behind. In fact, he may well still be using the place.
I suppose.
Starkweather sounded unenthusiastic about the whole business.
Most of the Shades' belongings were taken for spoils.
Spoils? Tessa echoed faintly. She remembered the term from the Codex.
Anything a Shadowhunter took from a downworlder who had been caught breaking the law belonged to him.
Those were the spoils of war. She looked across the table at Jem and Will, Jem's gentle eyes resting on her with concern, Will's haunted blue ones holding all their secrets. Did she really belong to a race of creatures that was at war with what Jem and Will were?
Spoils, Starkweather rumbled.
He had polished off his wine and started on Will's untouched glass.
Do those interest you, gal? We've quite a collection here in the Institute.
Puts the London collection to shame.
Or so I'm told.
He stood up, nearly knocking over his chair.
Come along. I'll show them to you. And tell you the rest of this sorry tale. Though there's not that much more to it.
Tessa looked quickly to Will and Jem for a cue. But they were already on their feet, following the old man out of the room. Starkweather spoke as he walked, his voice drifting back over his shoulder, making the rest of them hurry to match his long strides.
Never thought much of this reparations business myself, he said as they passed down another dimly lit, interminably long stone corridor. Makes downworlders uppity, thinking they have a right to get something out of us. All the work we do and no thanks, just hands held out for more, more, more. Don't you think so, gentlemen?
Bastards, all of them, said Will, who seemed as if his mind were 1,000 miles away. Jem looked at him sideways.
Absolutely, barked Starkweather, clearly pleased. Not that one should use such language in front of a lady, of course. As I was saying, this Mortmain was protesting the death of Anne Shade, the male warlock's wife. Said she had nothing to do with her husband's projects, hadn't known about them, he claimed. Her death was undeserved. Wanted a trial of those guilty of what he called murder, and his parents' belongings back.
Was the Book of the White among what he asked for? Jem inquired. I know it's a crime for a warlock to own such a volume.
It was. It was retrieved and placed in the London Institute Library, where no doubt it remains still. Certainly no one was going to give it to him.
Tessa did a quick mental calculation in her head. If he was 89 now, Starkweather would have been 26 at the time of the Shade's death. Were you there? His bloodshot eyes danced over her. She noticed that even now, a little drunk, he didn't seem to want to look at her too directly.
Well, was I where?
He You said an Enclave group was sent out to deal with the Shades. Were you among them?
He hesitated, then shrugged. Aye, he said, his Yorkshire accent thickening for a moment. Didn't take long to get the both of them. They weren't prepared. Not a bit. I remember them lying there in their blood. The first time I saw dead warlocks, I was surprised they bled red. I could have sworn it'd be another color, blue or green or some such. He shrugged. We took the cloaks off them, like skins off a tiger. I was given the keeping of them, or more rightly my father was. Glory, glory. Those were the days.
He grinned like a skull, and Tessa thought of Bluebeard's chamber where he kept the remains of the wives he had killed. She felt both very hot and very cold all over.
Mortmain never had a chance, did he? She said quietly. Filing his complaint like that, he was never going to get his reparations.
Of course not, barked Starkweather. Rubbish, all of it. Claiming the wife wasn't involved. What wife isn't neck deep in her husband's business? Besides, he wasn't even their blood son. Couldn't have been. Probably more of a pet to them than anything else. I'd wager the father would have used him for spare parts if it came down to it. He was better off without them. He should have been thanking us, not asking for a trial.
The old man broke off as he reached a heavy door at the end of the corridor and put his shoulder to it, grinning down at them from beneath beetling brows.
Have you ever been to the Crystal Palace?
Well, this is even better.
He shouldered the door open, and light blazed up around them as they passed through into the room beyond. Clearly, it was the only well-lit room in the place. The room was full of glass-fronted cabinets, and over each cabinet was a mounted lamp of witchlight, illuminating the contents within. Tessa saw Will's back stiffen, and Jem reached for her, his hand tightening on her arm with an almost bruising grip.
Don't, he began.
But she had pushed forward and was staring at the contents of the cabinets.
Spoils. A gold locket, open to a daguerreotype of a laughing child. The locket was splattered with dried blood. Behind her, Starkweather was talking about digging the silver bullets out of the bodies of freshly killed werewolves and melting them down to recast. There was a dish of such bullets, in fact, in one of the cabinets, filling a blood-stained bowl. Sets of vampire fangs, row and row of them. What looked like sheets of gossamer or delicate fabric pressed under glass. Only on closer inspection did Tessa realize they were the wings of fairies. A goblin, like the one she had seen with Jessamine in Hyde Park, floating open-eyed in a large jar of preservative fluid. And the remains of warlocks. Mummified, taloned hands, like Mrs. Black's. A stripped skull, utterly defleshed, human-looking, save that it had tusks instead of teeth. Vials of sludgy-looking blood. Starkweather was now talking about how much warlock parts, especially a warlock's mark, could be sold for on the downworld market. Tessa felt dizzy and hot, her eyes burning. Tessa turned around, her hands shaking. Jem and Will stood, looking at Starkweather with mute expressions of horror. The old man was holding up another hunting trophy, a human-looking head mounted to a backing. The skin had shriveled and gone grey, drawn back against the bones. Fleshless spiral horns protruded from the top of its skull.
"Got this off a warlock I killed down by Leedsware," he said.
"You wouldn't believe the fight he put up."
Starkweather's voice hollowed out, and Tessa felt herself suddenly cut free and floating. Darkness rushed up, and then there were arms around her, and Jem's voice. Words floated by her in ragged scraps. "My fiancé... never seen spoils before. Can't stand blood. Very delicate." Tessa wanted to fight free of Jem. Wanted to rush at Starkweather and strike the old man, but she knew it would ruin everything if she did. She clenched her eyes and shut and pressed her face against Jem's chest, breathing him in. He smelled of soap and sandalwood. Then there were other hands on her, drawing her away from Jem. Starkweather's maidservants. She heard Starkweather telling them to take her upstairs and help her to bed.
She opened her eyes to see Jem's troubled face as he looked after her, until the door of the spoils room closed between them.
It took Tessa a long time to fall asleep that night, and when she did, she had a nightmare. In the dream, she lay manacled to the brass bed in the house of the Dark Sisters. Light, like thin gray soup, seeped through the windows. The door opened, and Mrs. Dark came in, followed by her sister, who had no head, only the white bone of her spine protruding from her raggedly severed neck.
"Here she is, the pretty, pretty princess," said Mrs. Dark, clapping her hands together. "Just think of what we will get for all the pots of her, 100 each for her little white hands, and 1,000 for the pair of her eyes. We'd get more if they were blue, of course, but one can't have everything."
She chuckled, and the bed began to spin as Tessa screamed and thrashed in the darkness. Faces appeared above her. Mort Mayne, his narrow features screwed up in amusement.
"And they say the worth of a good woman is far above rubies," he said. "What of the worth of a warlock?"
"Put her in a cage, I say, and let the groundlings stare at her for pennies," said Nate, and suddenly the bars of a cage sprang up around her, and he was laughing at her from the other side, his pretty face twisted up in scorn. Henry was there too, shaking his head.
"I've taken her all apart," he said, "and I can't say what makes the heart of hers beat. Still, it's quite a curiosity, isn't it?"
He opened his hand, and there was something red and fleshy on his palm, pulsing and contracting, like a fish flipped out of water, gasping for air.
"See how it's divided into two quite equal parts."
"Tess,"
a voice came urgently in her ear.
"Tess, you're dreaming. Wake up. Wake up."
Hands were on her shoulders, shaking her. Her eyes flew open, and she was gasping in her ugly, gray, dimly lit bedroom at the York Institute. The covers were tangled around her, and her nightgown stuck to her back with sweat. Her skin felt as if it were burning. She still saw the Dark Sisters, saw Nate laughing at her, Henry dissecting her heart.
It was a dream," she said. "It felt so real, so utterly real."
She broke off.
"Will,"
she whispered. He still wore his dinner clothes, though they were rumpled, his black hair tangled as if he had fallen asleep without changing for bed. His hands remained on her shoulders, warming her cold skin through the material of her nightgown.
"What did you dream?" he said.
His tone was calm and ordinary, as if there were nothing unusual about her waking up and finding him sitting on the edge of her bed. She shuddered at the memory.
"I dreamed I was being taken apart, that bits of me were being put on display for shadow hunters to laugh at."
"Tess,"
he touched her hair gently, pushing the tangled locks behind her ears. She felt pulled to him, like iron filings to a magnet. Her arms ached to go around him, her head to rest in the crook of his shoulder.
"God damn that devil Starkweather for showing you what he did. But you must know it's not like that anymore. The Accords have forbidden spoils. It was just a dream."
"But no," she thought. "This is the dream."
Her eyes had adjusted to the dark. The gray light in the room made his eyes glow an almost unearthly blue like a cat's. When she drew a shuddering breath, her lungs felt filled with the scent of him. Will and salt and trains and smoke and rain. And she wondered if he had been out, walking the streets of York as he did in London.
"Where have you been?" she whispered.
"You smell like nighttime."
"Out kicking over the traces, as usual."
He touched her cheek with warm, calloused fingers.
"Can you sleep now?" "We're meant to rise early tomorrow.
Starkweather is lending us his carriage so that we might investigate Ravenscar Manor. You, of course, are welcome to remain here. You need not accompany us. She shuddered. Stay here without you? In this big, gloomy place? I would prefer not to. Tess. His voice was ever so gentle. That must have been quite a nightmare, to have taken the spirit out of you so. Usually you are not afraid of much. It was awful. Even Henry was in my dream. He was taking apart my heart, as if it were made of clockwork. Well, that settles it, Will said. Pure fantasy. As if Henry is a danger to anyone except himself. When she didn't smile, he added, fiercely, I would never let anyone touch a hair on your head. You know that, don't you, Tess? Their gazes caught and locked. She thought of the wave that seemed to catch at her whenever she was near Will, how she had felt herself drawn over and under, pulled to him by forces that seemed beyond her control. In the attic, on the roof of the Institute, as if he felt the same pull, he bent toward her now. It felt natural, as right as breathing, to lift her head, to meet his lips with hers. She felt his soft exhalation against her mouth. Relief. As if a great weight had been taken from him. His hands rose to cup her face. Even as her eyes fluttered shut, she heard his voice in her head, again, unbidden. There is no future for a shadow hunter who dallies with warlocks. She turned her face quickly, and his lips brushed her cheek instead of her mouth. He drew back, and she saw his blue eyes open, startled and hurt. No, she said. No, I don't know that, Will. She dropped her voice. You have made it very clear, she said. What kind of use you have for me? You think I am a toy for your amusements. You should not have come in here. It is not proper. He dropped his hands. You cooled out. Not for you. He was silent, except for his ragged breathing. Do you regret what you said to me that night on the roof, Will? The night of Thomas's and Agatha's funeral? It was the first time either of them had made reference to the incident since it had happened. Can you tell me you did not mean what you said? He bent his head. His hair fell forward, hiding his face. She clenched her own hands into fists at her sides to stop herself from reaching out and pushing it back. No, he said, very low. No, the angel forgive me. I can't say that. Tessa withdrew, curling in on herself, turning her face away. Please go away, Will. Tessa, please. There was a long silence. He stood up then, the bed creaking beneath him as he moved. She heard his light tread on the floorboards, and then the door of the bedroom shutting behind him. As if the sound had snapped some cord that held her upright, she fell back against the pillows. She stared up at the ceiling a long time, fighting back in vain against the questions that crowded her mind. What had Will meant, coming to her room like that? Why had he shown her such sweetness when she knew that he despised her? And why, when she knew that he was the worst thing in the world for her, did sending him away seem like such a terrible mistake?
The next morning dawned unexpectedly blue and beautiful, a balm to Tessa's aching head and exhausted body. After dragging herself from the bed where she had spent most of the night tossing and turning, she dressed herself, unable to bear the thought of assistance from one of the ancient half-blind maidservants. As she did up the buttons on her jacket, she caught sight of herself in the room's old, splotched mirror. There were half-moons of shadows under her eyes, as if they had been smudged there with chalk. Will and Jem had already gathered in the morning room for a breakfast of half-burned toast, weak tea, jam, and no butter. By the time Tessa arrived, Jem had already eaten, and Will was busy cutting his toast into thin strips and forming rude pictographs out of them. "What is that supposed to be?" Jem asked curiously. "It looks almost like a..." He glanced up, saw Tessa, and broke off with a grin. "Good morning."
"Good morning."
She slid into the seat across from Will. He glanced up at her once as she sat, but there was nothing in his eyes or expression to indicate that he recalled that anything had passed between them the night before. Jem looked at her with concern. "Tessa, how are you feeling? After last night..." He broke off then, his voice rising. "Good morning, Mr. Starkweather," he said hastily, jostling Will's shoulder hard so that Will dropped his fork and the toast bits slid all over his plate. Mr. Starkweather, who had swept into the room still wrapped in the dark cloak he had worn the night before, regarded him balefully. "The carriage is waiting for you in the courtyard," he said, his clipped diction as tight as ever. "You better cut a stick if you want to get back before dinner time. I'll be needing the carriage this evening. I've told Gottschall to drop you straight at the station on your return. No need for lingering. I trust you've gotten everything you need." It wasn't a question. Jem nodded. "Yes, sir. You've been very gracious." Starkweather's eyes swept over Tessa again, one last time, before he turned and stalked out of the room, his cloak flapping behind him. Tessa couldn't get the image of a great black bird of prey, a vulture perhaps, out of her mind. She thought of the trophy cases full of spoils and shuddered. "Eat quickly, Tessa, before he changes his mind about the carriage," Will advised her, but Tessa shook her head. "I'm not hungry. At least have tea." Will poured it out for her and ladled milk and sugar into it. It was much sweeter than Tessa would have liked, but it was so rare that Will made a kind of gesture like that, even if it was just to hurry her along, that she drank it down anyway and managed a few bites of toast. The boys went for their coats and the baggage. Tessa's traveling cloak, hat, and gloves were located, and they soon found themselves on the front steps of the York Institute, blinking in the watery sunlight. Starkweather had been as good as his word. His carriage was there, waiting for them, the four C's of the clave painted across the door. The old coachman with the long white beard and hair was already in the driver's seat, smoking a cheroot. He tossed it aside when he saw the three of them, and sank down farther in his seat, his black eyes glaring out from beneath his drooping eyelids.
"Bloody hell, it's the Ancient Mariner again," said Will,
though he seemed more entertained than anything else. He swung himself up into the carriage and helped Tessa in after him. Jem was last, shutting the door behind him and leaning out the window to call the coachman to drive on. Tessa, settling herself in beside Will on the narrow seat, felt her shoulder brush his. He tensed immediately, and she moved away, biting her lip. It was as if last night had never happened, and he were back to behaving as if she were poison. The carriage began moving with a jerk that nearly flung Tessa into Will again, but she braced herself against the window and stayed where she was. The three of them were silent as the carriage rolled down narrow, cobbled Stonegate Street, under a wild sign advertising the old Star Inn. Both Jem and Will were quiet, Will reviving only to tell her with a ghoulish glee that they were passing through the old walls, under the city entrance, where once traitors' heads had been displayed on spikes. Tessa made a face at him, but gave no reply. Once they had passed the walls, the city quickly gave way to countryside. The landscape was not gentle and rolling, but harsh and forbidding. Green hills, dotted with grey gorse, swept up into crags of dark rock. Long lines of mortarless stone walls meant for keeping in sheep crisscrossed the green. Here and there was dotted the occasional lonely cottage. The sky seemed an endless expanse of blue brushed with the strokes of long grey clouds. Tessa could not have said how long they had been travelling when the stone chimneys of a large manor house rose in the distance. Jem stuck his head out of the window and called to the driver. The carriage came to a rolling stop.
"But we're not there yet," said Tessa, puzzled. "If that's Ravenscar Manor..."
"We can't just roll right up to the front door. Be sensible, Tess," said Will, as Jem leaped out of the carriage and reached up to help Tessa down. Her boots plashed into the wet, muddy ground as she landed. Will dropped down lightly beside her. We need to get a look at the place. Use Henry's device to register demonic presence. Make sure we're not walking into a trap. Does Henry's device actually work? Tessa lifted her skirts to keep them out of the mud as the three of them started down the road. Glancing back, she saw the coachman apparently already asleep, leaning back in the driver's seat with his hat tipped forward over his face. All around them, the countryside was a patchwork of gray and green, hills rising starkly, their sides pitted with a gray shale, flat sheep-cropped grass, and here and there, copses of gnarled and twined trees. There was a severe beauty to it all, but Tessa shuddered at the idea of living here, so far away from anything. Jem, seeing her shudder, gave a sideways smile. City lass. Tessa laughed. I was thinking how odd it would be to grow up in a place like this. So far away from any people. Where I grew up was not so different from this, said Will, unexpectedly, startling them both. It's not so lonely as you might think, out in the countryside. You can be assured. People visit one another a great deal. They just have a greater distance to traverse than they might in London. And once they arrive, they often make a lengthy stay. After all, why make the trip just to stay a night or two? We'd often have house guests who remain for weeks. Tessa goggled at Will silently. It was so rare that he ever referred to anything regarding his early life that she sometimes thought of him as someone with no past at all. Jem seemed to be doing the same thing, though he recovered first. I share Tessa's view. I have never lived in anything but a city. I don't know how I could sleep at night, not knowing I was surrounded by 1,000 other sleeping, dreaming souls. And filth everywhere. And everyone breathing down one another's necks, countered Will. When I first arrived in London, I so quickly tired of being surrounded by so many people that it was only with great difficulty that I refrained from seizing the next unfortunate who crossed my path and committing violent acts upon their person. Some might say you retain that problem, said Tessa, but Will just laughed, a short, nearly surprised sound of amusement, and then stopped, looking ahead of them to Ravenscar Manor. Jem whistled as Tessa realized why she had been able to see only the tops of the chimneys before. The manor was built in the center of a deep declivity between three hills. Their slanting sides rose about it, cradling it, as if in the palm of a hand. Tessa, Jem, and Will were poised on the edge of one of the hills, looking down at the manor. The building itself was very grand, a gray stone pile that gave the impression it had been there for centuries. A large circular drive curved in front of the enormous front doors. Nothing about the place hinted at abandonment or disrepair. No weeds grew over the drive or the paths that led to the stone outbuildings, and no glass was missing from the mullioned windows. Someone's living here, said Jem, echoing Tessa's thoughts. He began to start down the hill. The grass here was longer, waving, almost waist high. Perhaps if... He broke off as the rattle of wheels became audible. For a moment, Tessa thought the carriage driver had come after them, but no, this was quite a different carriage. A sturdy-looking coach that had turned into the gate and begun rolling toward the manor. Jem crouched down immediately in the grass. Will and Tessa dropped beside him. They watched as the carriage came to a stop before the manor, and the driver leaped down to open the carriage door. A young girl stepped out, 14 or 15 years old. Tessa guessed, not old enough to have put her hair up, for it blew around her in a curtain of black silk. She wore a blue dress, plain but fashionable. She nodded to the driver, and then, as she started up the manor steps, she paused. Paused and looked toward where Jem, Will, and Tessa crouched, almost as if she could see them, though Tessa was sure that they were well hidden by the grass. The distance was too great for Tessa to make out her features, really, just the pale oval of her face below the dark hair. She was about to ask Jem if he had a telescope with him, when Will made a noise she had never heard anyone make before, a sick, terrible gasp, as if the air had been punched out of him by a tremendous blow. But it was not just a gasp, she realized. It was a word. And not just a word, a name. And not just a name, but one she had heard him say before. Cecily.
Chapter 6 In Silence Sealed. The human heart has hidden treasures, in secret kept, in silence sealed. The thoughts, the hopes, the dreams, the pleasures, whose charms were broken, if revealed. Charlotte Bronte, Evening Solace. The door of the great house swung open. The girl disappeared inside. The coach rattled off around the side of the manor to the coach house as Will staggered to his feet. He had gone a sickly gray color, like the ashes of a dead fire.
"Cicely," he said again.
His voice held wonderment and horror. "Who on earth is Cicely?" Tessa scrambled into a standing position, brushing grass and thistles from her dress. "Will?" Jem was already beside Will, his hand on his friend's shoulder.
"Will, you must speak to us. You look as if you've seen a ghost."
Will dragged in a long breath.
"Cicely."
"Yes, you've said that already," said Tessa. She heard the sharpness in her own voice and softened it with an effort. It was unkind to speak so to someone so obviously distraught, even if he did insist on staring into space and muttering "Cicely" at intervals. It hardly mattered. Will seemed not to have heard her.
"My sister," he said. "Cicely. She was... Christ, she was 9 years old when I left."
"Your sister," said Jem, and Tessa felt a loosening of something tight around her heart, and cursed herself inwardly for it. What did it matter whether Cicely was Will's sister or someone he was in love with? It had nothing to do with her. Will started down the hill, not looking for a path, just tramping blindly among the heather and furze. After a moment, Jem went after him, catching at his sleeve.
"Will, don't!"
Will tried to pull his arm away.
"If Cicely's there, then the rest of them, my family, they must be there as well."
Tessa hurried to catch up with them, wincing as she nearly turned an ankle on a loose rock. "But it doesn't make any sense that your family would be here, Will. This was Mortmain's house. Starkweather said so. It was in the papers."
"I know that," Will half-shouted.
"Cicely could be visiting someone here." Will gave her an incredulous look.
"In the middle of Yorkshire, by herself? And that was our carriage. I recognized it. There's no other carriage in the carriage house. No, my family's in this somehow. They've been dragged into this bloody business, and I have to warn them."
He started down the hill again.
"Will!"
Jem shouted and went after him, catching at the back of his coat. Will swung around and shoved Jem, not very hard. Tessa heard Jem say something about Will having held back all these years and not wasting it now, and then it all blurred together. Will swearing and Jem yanking him backward, and Will slipping on the wet ground and the both of them going over together, a rolling tangle of arms and legs, until they fetched up against a large rock. Jem pinning Will to the ground, his elbow against the other boy's throat.
"Get off me,"
Will shoved at him.
"You don't understand. Your family's dead." "Will!"
Jem took his friend by the shirt front and shook him.
"I do understand. And unless you want your family dead too, you'll listen to me."
Will went very still. In a choked voice, he said,
"James, you can't possibly. I've never. Look."
Jem raised the hand that wasn't gripping Will's shirt and pointed.
"There. Look."
Tessa looked where he was pointing and felt her insides freeze. They were nearly halfway down the hill above the manor house, and there, above them, standing like a sort of sentry on the ridge at the hill's top, was an automaton. She knew immediately what it was, though it did not look like the automatons that Mortmain had sent against them before. Those had made some surface pretense of being human.
This was a tall, spindly metal creature with long, hinged legs, a twisted metallic torso, and saw-like arms. It was utterly still, not moving, somehow more frightening for its stillness and silence. Tessa could not even tell if it was watching them. It seemed to be turned toward them, but though it had a head, that head was featureless, but for the slash of a mouth. Metal teeth gleamed within. It seemed to have no eyes. Tessa quelled the scream rising in her throat. It was an automaton. She had faced them before. She would not scream. Will, propped on his elbow, was staring. By the angel. That thing's been following us, I'm sure of it, said Jem in a low, urgent voice. I saw a flash of metal earlier from the carriage, but I wasn't sure. Now I am. If you go tearing off down the hill, you risk leading that thing right to your family's door. I see, Will said. The half-hysterical tone had gone from his voice. I won't go near the house. Let me up. Jem hesitated. I swear on Raziel's name, Will ground out between his teeth. Now let me up. Jem rolled away and onto his feet. Will leaped up, pushing Jem aside, and, without a glance at Tessa, took off running. Not toward the house, but away from it. Toward the mechanical creature on the ridge. Jem staggered for a moment, open-mouthed, swore, and darted after him. Jem! Tessa cried, but he was nearly out of earshot already, racing after Will. The automaton had vanished from view. Tessa said an unladylike word, hiked up her skirts, and gave chase. It was not easy, running up a wet Yorkshire hill in heavy skirts, brambles tearing at her as she went. Practicing in her training clothes had given Tessa a new appreciation for why it was that men could move so quickly and cleanly, and could run so fast. The material of her dress weighed a ton. The heels on her boots caught on rocks as she ran, and her corset left her uncomfortably short of breath. By the time she reached the top of the ridge, she was only just in time to see Jem, far ahead of her, disappear into a dark copse of trees. She looked around wildly, but could see neither the road nor the Starkweather's carriage. With her heart pounding, she dashed after him. The copse was wide, spreading along the ridgeline. The moment Tessa ducked in among the trees, the light vanished. Thick tree branches interweaving above her blocked out the sun. Feeling like Snow White fleeing into the forest, she looked around helplessly for a sign of where the boys had gone. Broken branches, trodden leaves, and caught a shimmer of light on metal as the automaton surged out of the dark space between two trees and lunged for her. She screamed, leaping away, and promptly tripped on her skirts. She went over backward, thumping painfully into the muddy earth. The creature stabbed one of its long, insectile arms toward her. She rolled aside, and the metal arm sliced into the ground beside her. There was a fallen tree branch near her. Her fingers scrabbled at it, closed around it, and lifted it, just as the creature's other arm swung toward her. She swept the branch between them, concentrating on the parrying and blocking lessons she'd gotten from Gabriel. But it was only a branch. The automaton's metal arm sheared it in half. The end of the arm sprang open into a multi-fingered metal claw and reached for her throat. But before it could touch her, Tessa felt a violent fluttering against her collarbone. Her angel. She lay frozen as the creature jerked its claw back, one of its fingers leaking black fluid. A moment later, it gave a high-pitched whine and collapsed backward, a freshet of more black liquid pouring from the hole that had been sliced clean through its chest. Tessa sat up and stared. Will stood with a sword in his hand, its hilt smeared with black. He was bareheaded, his thick dark hair tousled and tangled with leaves and bits of grass. Jem stood beside him, a witch-light stone blazing through his fingers. As Tessa watched, Will slashed out with the sword again, cutting the automaton nearly in half. It crumpled to the muddy ground. Its insides were an ugly, horribly biological-looking mess of tubes and wires. Jem looked up. His gaze met Tessa's. His eyes were as silver as mirrors. Will, despite having saved her, did not appear to notice she was there at all. He drew back his foot and delivered a savage kick to the metal creature's side. His boot rang against metal.
"Tell us," he said through gritted teeth. "What are you doing here? Why are you following us?"
The automaton's razor-lined mouth opened. Its voice, when it spoke, sounded like the buzzing and grinding of faulty machinery.
"I am a warning from the Magister." "A warning to who? To the family in the manor? Tell me!"
Will looked as if he were going to kick the creature again. Jem laid a hand on his shoulder.
"Doesn't feel pain, Will," he said in a low voice. "And it says it has a message. Let it deliver it."
"A warning to you, Will Arendelle, and to all Nephilim,"
the creature's broken voice ground out.
"The Magister says you must cease your investigation. The past is the past. Leave Mortmains buried, or your family will pay the price. Do not dare approach or warn them. If you do, they will be destroyed."
Jem was looking at Will. Will was still ashy pale, but his cheeks were burning with rage.
"How did Mortmain bring my family here? Did he threaten them? What has he done?"
The creature whirred and clicked, then began to speak again.
"I am a warning from..."
Will snarled like an animal and slashed down with the sword. Tessa remembered Jessamine in Hyde Park, tearing a fairy creature to ribbons with her delicate parasol. Will cut at the automaton until it was little more than ribbons of metal. Jem, throwing his arms around his friend and yanking him bodily backward, finally stopped him.
"Will," he said. "Will, enough."
He glanced up, and the other two followed his gaze. In the distance, through the trees, other shapes moved. More automatons like this one.
"We must go," Jem said. "If we want to draw them off, away from your family, we must leave."
Will hesitated.
"Will, you know you cannot go near them," Jem said desperately. "If nothing else, it is the law. If we bring danger to them, the Clave will not move to help them in any way. They are not shadow hunters anymore. Will!"
Slowly, Will lowered his arm to his side. He stood, with one of Jem's arms still around his shoulders, staring down at the pile of scrap metal at his feet. Black liquid dripped from the blade of the sword that dangled in his hand and scorched the grass below. Tessa exhaled. She hadn't realized she'd been holding her breath until that moment. Will must have heard her, for he raised his head and his gaze met hers across the clearing. Something in it made her look away. Agony, stripped so raw, was not meant for her eyes. In the end, they hid the remains of the destroyed automaton as swiftly as possible, by burying them in the soft earth beneath a rotting log. Tessa helped as best she could, hampered by her skirts. By the end of it, her hands were as black with dirt and mud as Will's and Jem's were. None of them spoke. They worked in an eerie silence. When they were done, Will led the way out of the copse, guided by the light of Jem's witch-light runestone. They emerged from the woods nearly at the road,
where the Starkweather carriage waited, Gottschall dozing in the driver's seat, as if only a few moments had passed since they had arrived. If their appearances, filthy, smeared with mud and with leaves caught in their hair, surprised the old man at all, he didn't show it, nor did he ask them if they had found what they had come looking for. He only grunted a hello, and waited for them to climb up into the carriage before he signaled the horses with a click of his tongue to turn around and begin the long journey back to York. The curtains inside the carriage were drawn back. The sky was heavy with blackish clouds pressing down on the horizon. "It's going to rain," Jem said, pushing damp silvery hair out of his eyes. Will said nothing. He was staring out the window. His eyes were the color of the Arctic Sea at night. "Cecily," said Tessa, in a much gentler voice than she was used to using with Will these days. He looked so miserable, as bleak and stark as the moors they were passing through. "Your sister, she looks like you." Will remained silent. Tessa, seated next to Jem on the hard seat, shivered a little. Her clothes were damp from the wet earth and branches, and the inside of the carriage was cold. Jem reached down and, finding a slightly ragged lap rug, settled it over the both of them. She could feel the heat that radiated off his body, as if he were feverish, and fought the urge to move closer to him to get warm. "Are you cold, Will?" she asked, but he only shook his head, his eyes still staring, unseeing, at the passing countryside. She looked at Jem in desperation. Jem spoke, his voice clear and direct. "Will," he said, I thought that your sister was dead." Will drew his gaze from the window and looked at them both. When he smiled, it was ghastly. "My sister is dead," he said. And that was all he would say. They rode the rest of the way back to the city of York in silence. Having barely slept the night before, Tessa fell in and out of a fitful doze that lasted until they reached the York train station. In a fog, she dismounted from the carriage and followed the others to the London platform. They were late for the train, and nearly missed it, and Jem held the door open for her and Will, as both of them stumbled up the steps and into the compartment after him. Later, she would remember the way he looked, hanging on to the door, hatless, calling to both of them, and recall staring out the window of the train as it pulled away, seeing Gottschall standing on the platform looking after them with his unsettling dark eyes, his hat pulled low. Everything else was a blur. There was no conversation this time as the train puffed its way through countryside, increasingly darkened by clouds. Only silence. Tessa rested her chin on her palm, cradling her head against the hard glass of the window. Green hills flew by, and small towns and villages, each with their own neat, small station, the name of it picked out in gold on a red sign. Church spires rose in the distance, cities swelled and vanished, and Tessa was aware of Jem whispering to Will, in Latin, she thought. "Me specta, me specta." And Will not answering. Later, she was aware that Jem had left the compartment, and she looked at Will across the small dimming space between them. The sun had begun to go down, and it lent a rosy flush to his skin, belying the blank look in his eyes. "Will," she said softly, sleepily, "last night, you were kind to me," she was going to say. "Thank you." The glare from his blue eyes stabbed through her.
"There was no last night," he said through his teeth.
At that, she sat up straight, almost awake.
"Oh, truly? We just went right from one afternoon on through till the next morning? How odd no one else has remarked on it. I should think it some sort of miracle, a day with no night."
"Don't test me, Tessa."
Will's hands were clenched on his knees, his fingernails, half-moons of dirt under them, digging into the fabric of his trousers. "Your sister's alive," she said, knowing perfectly well that she was provoking him. "Oughtn't you be glad?" He whitened.
"Tessa,"
he began, and leaned forward as if he meant to do she knew not what. Strike the window and break it, shake her by the shoulders, or hold her as if he never meant to let her go. It was all one great bewilderment with him, wasn't it? Then the compartment door opened and Jem came in, carrying a damp cloth. He looked from Will to Tessa and raised his silvery eyebrows.
"A miracle," he said. "You got him to speak."
"Just to shout at me, really," said Tessa. "Not quite loaves and fishes." Will had gone back to staring out the window, and looked at neither of them as they spoke.
"It's a start," said Jem,
and he sat down beside her.
"Here, give me your hands."
Surprised, Tessa held her hands out to him, and was horrified. They were filthy, the nails cracked and broken and thick with half-moons of dirt where she had clawed at the Yorkshire earth. There was even a bloody scratch across her knuckles, though she had no memory of having gotten it. Not a lady's hands. She thought of Jessamine's perfect pink and white paws.
"Jessie would be horrified," she said mournfully. "She'd tell me I had charwoman's hands." "And what, pray tell, is dishonorable about that?"
said Jem as he gently cleaned the dirt from her scratches.
"I saw you chase after us, and that automaton creature. If Jessamine does not know by now that there is honor in blood and dirt, she never will."
The cool cloth felt good on her fingers. She looked up at Jem, who was intent on his task, his lashes a fringe of lowered silver.
"Thank you," she said. "I doubt I was any help at all, and probably a hindrance, but thank you all the same."
He smiled at her, the sun coming out from behind clouds.
"That's what we're training you for, isn't it?"
She lowered her voice.
"Have you any idea what could have happened? Why Will's family would be living in a house Mortmain once owned?"
Jem glanced over at Will, who was still staring bitterly out the window. They had entered London, and grey buildings were beginning to rise up around them on either side. The look Jem gave Will was a tired, loving sort of look, a familiar look, and Tessa realized that, though when she had imagined them as brothers, she had always imagined Will as the older, the caretaker, and Jem as the younger, the reality was far more complicated than that.
"I do not," he said, "though it makes me think the game Mortmain is playing is a long one. Somehow he knew exactly where our investigations would lead us, and he arranged for this encounter to shock us as much as possible. He wishes us to be reminded who it is who has the power."
Tessa shuddered. "I don't know what he wants from me, Jem," she said in a low voice. "When he said to me that he made me, it was as if he were saying he could unmake me just as easily." Jem's warm arm touched hers.
"You cannot be unmade," he said just as softly. "And Mortmain underestimates you. I saw how you used that branch against the automaton. It was not enough, if it had not been for my angel."
Tessa touched the pendant at her throat.
"The automaton touched it and recoiled. Another mystery I do not understand. It protected me before, and again this time, but in other situations lies dormant. It is as much a mystery as my talent."
"Which, fortunately, you did not need to use to change into Starkweather. He seemed quite happy simply to give us the shade files."
"Thank goodness," said Tessa. "I wasn't looking forward to it. He seems such an unpleasant, bitter man. But if it ever turns out to be necessary..."
She took something from her pocket and held it up, something that glinted in the carriage's dim light.
"A button," she said smugly. "It fell from the cuff of his jacket this morning, and I picked it up."
Jem smiled.
"Very clever, Tessa. I knew we'd be glad we brought you with us."
He broke off with a cough, Tessa looked at him in alarm, and even Will was roused out of his silent despondency, turning to look at Jem with narrowed eyes. Jem coughed again, his hand pressed to his mouth. But when he took it away, there was no blood visible. Tessa saw Will's shoulders relax.
"Just some dust in my throat," Jem reassured them.
He looked not ill, but very tired, though his exhaustion only served to point up the delicacy of his features. His beauty did not blaze like Will's did, in fierce colors and repressed fire, but it had its own muted perfection. The loveliness of snow falling against a silver-gray sky.
"Your ring!"
She started up suddenly as she remembered that she was still wearing it. She put the button back into her pocket, then reached to draw the Carstairs ring off her hand. "I had meant to give it back to you earlier," she said, placing the silver circlet in his palm. "I forgot." He curled his fingers around hers. Despite her thoughts of snow and gray skies, his hand was surprisingly warm.
"That's all right,"
he said in a low voice.
"I like the way it looks on you."
She felt her cheeks warm. Before she could answer, the train whistle sounded. Voices cried out that they were in London, King's Cross Station. The train began to slow as the platform came into view. The hubbub of the station rose to assault Tessa's ears, along with the sound of the train braking. Jem said something, but his words were lost in the noise. Sounded like a warning, but Will was already on his feet, his hand reaching for the compartment door latch. He swung it open and leaped out and down. If he were not a shadow hunter, Tessa thought, he would have fallen, and badly. But as it was, he simply landed lightly on his feet and began to run, pushing his way among the crowding porters, the commuters, the gentility traveling north for the weekend with their massive trunks and hunting hounds on leashes, the newspaper boys and pickpockets and costermongers and all the other human traffic of the Grand Station. Jem was on his feet, hand reaching for the door, but he turned back and looked at Tessa, and she saw an expression cross his face, an expression that said that he